Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Really excited because with us today, we have Levi King. Levi is the CEO and chairman at NAV. Levi, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Appreciate you having me on.
Awesome. So why don't we get started with NAV? We'd love to know what problem the company is solving in the marketplace.
Yeah, we solve credit financial health for small businesses. So we have a software platform where they gain access to their personal credit, all three commercial bureaus, and they plug in their cash flow data as well. So we can give them advice on how to make smarter financial decisions and how to build their business credit over time, which there's a lot of benefits to, whether it's trade credit. Your whole vendor network uses your business credit and sometimes personal credit, whether it's your merchant processor, your insurer, of course, all of your lenders. That one's a little bit more obvious, whether it's a business credit card or business loan that you need. And in some industries, your potential customers are going to check your credit. So it's really about establishing, improving, and protecting your business and financial health over time as a small business owner.
And what was the inspiration? What gave you the idea to start the business?
It was a bit long time in coming. I started my first, I'll use air quotes, company. I was a sole prop fixing electric signs in my early 20s and bootstrapped my way pretty quick into installation and then actually bootstrapped my way all the way into manufacturing. And in that business, my credit mattered all the time, not just for financing, but you know, I had trade credit terms of net 30, net 60, net 90, even as much as net 180 with my steel supplier, plastic supplier, paint supplier. And you, in that business, you bid a job. It's a $100,000 job. You get 50% down. And so at first your customer is a creditor to you. And as soon in the margin, that business was 10 to 15%. So as soon as I'm 50% costed to the job now, now I'm a creditor to them. And so having trade credit with all my suppliers helped push out when I had to pay for things so that it was a lot easier to cash flow the growth of the business. That was the first of five small businesses. I started in my 20s that were all in different industry verticals. They were all successful, sold them all. And it was very difficult to understand how credit and financing or credit and financial health in general applied to this whole ecosystem. So once I thought I had it nailed as a manufacturer, I bought a hotel. Turns out that's a high risk industry. I didn't even know there was such a thing as high risk. Manufacturing is low risk, and I had to learn it all over again. And so I really wanted to solve that credit health and the financing question for small businesses. So I started Lendio, which is a venture-backed, late-stage, profitable fintech that focuses on brokering business loans digitally. And I just felt this need to solve like the underlying problem. So however you manage your data, that's what impacts what your options are for financing at any given time. But there was nobody that had built a software and data platform to help you understand, establish, manage, and protect your business and your business credit specifically, but also your personal credit as a business owner and your financial health overall. And so that was the impetus. And here we are a little more than 10 years later, $100 million raised from great venture capitalists. Burned $87 million before we turned our first dollar of profit, which was because of how I grew up in business, entirely uncomfortable, and I hated every minute of it. But now we got a million customers around the country in different industry verticals. So it's kind of like my whole career led to this moment and this impact and legacy that we want to leave on the small business part subset of our economy.
Wow. A whole bunch to unpack here. Let's start with your 20s. First off, I tip my hat to you for being a lifelong entrepreneur. One of the topics that comes up is, you know, professionals who start later in their career. You know, love to hear, you know, what was it back when you were in your 20s that inspired and motivated you to get started with being your own boss?
I knew I wanted to start my own company. I was raised on a farm in rural Idaho. I didn't label it small business. I didn't understand any of that stuff back then, but my dad was a small business owner. It happened to be a farm. And so I knew I wanted to chart my own course. I went to college. I skipped a year of high school. I wanted to get away from the farm and American poverty as quick as I could. Got expelled from college. Turns out if you go to a religious school and you don't plan on following the religion, that's not a great academic plan. So then I enrolled at a state school and got a job at an electric sign company to pay my bills, put myself through school. And it was a small business, just the owner and a few employees. And he'd been out of the manufacturing game and just did installation and servicing. And after about a year, he asked me, he said, "Hey, what are you going to do when you're done with college?" And I said, "I don't know. I know I want to own my own business." And he said, "Well, hey, if you'll stick around another year, I'll teach you how this business works as long as you'll leave the state and go do it somewhere else." And I was from Idaho. This was at the time I was living in Utah. And so we handshook that and moved to Idaho, and being so naive really helped me out. I didn't know how difficult it all was going to be. And my first month, I profited 8 grand. I cold called, I drove around at night, looked for burnout electric signs, and I cold called the next day and offered to fix the sign. And that turned into an $8,000 profit, which let me buy a shitty old boom truck that could get me 80 feet in there. So I wasn't constrained to servicing signs with a ladder, and then got the installation game. So I kind of always knew I wanted to do my own thing, but I stumbled into that first business thanks to Brad Kirk at Hallmark Signs in Provo, Utah.
Shout out to Brad. That's great. And I hear an element of there of just hustling. And it's brilliant. I think we now have enough sources of information where founders realize that in the beginning you have to just be innovative and think about new ways to pick up clients. So the fact that you were driving around looking at burnt out signs is brilliant. I love it. You also, I heard you mentioned, effectively something that sounds like ignorance is bliss. And then as your career progressed, not necessarily under having a full appreciation of what it was going to be like to own a hotel. I'd love to hear today how your understanding of risk management has evolved back when you're in your 20s, when you own the hotel. And how you think about today interacting with business owners who are conscious of their credit.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a lot more complex and kind of organized, the framework that I think through today. I mean, all of business is gambling. It's just hopefully informed gambling, and you know what the risks you're going to take, whether that's money or risk with people or distribution or whatever. It usually comes back to money, though. You're taking a risk with money. You have your potential payoff, and there's some equation there of the odds and probabilities of success. Back, it was really simple equation back when I started my first company, because my bills were almost nothing, and I had to sell enough work to pay those small bills. It got a lot more complex when I got into manufacturing, and I had, luckily I'm a left brainer, and I liked math because you had to predict or estimate all the materials that were going to go into the job. That was easier, right? You could see, like, okay, it's this much steel, it's this much sheet metal. The labor was less. It was more complicated to gauge the labor costs. So I'm going to my employees saying, like, "Hey, how long is this going to take you?" They don't necessarily know, so then you build in a little buffer in case margins are tight. So I was lucky to kind of ease my way into from a really simple calculation of taking the risk to more and more complicated risk. And then, of course, getting into this venture-backed world, NAV is a company that was impossible to bootstrap. Like, there was zero chance you could bootstrap this business. Like I said, we burned $87 million before we turned a dime of profit. But everything that I'd done up until then kind of led to a moment where it was a lot easier to decide how to spend how much money on what, when, to just make that incremental progress. Because when you raise venture capital, it's a game of, you raise that seed round. In my case, it was $500,000. I put in the first $500,000 myself, and you got $500,000 to make enough progress to convince somebody else to give you a bigger check at a higher valuation. And that game doesn't end until you're profitable. And even then, sometimes it doesn't end because you want to go internationally, you want to focus on inorganic growth, something else. So I was able to kind of ease into understanding how to spend money, where and on what, and how fast to make that commercial progress along the way to get to that next round of financing at a better valuation. And so now I think of it all in reverse for my customers. And so, we serve small business. We don't serve tech companies. Very Main Street business. We've got about 1 million users all across the country, pretty evenly distributed across geo, across time of business, against size of business. And so we package up the data and show them that back to them with insights on how to improve based on the industry they're in, based on their time of business, based on all of the factors that go into how do third parties make risk-based decisions on you. And you know, if you're getting a loan, there's only two reasons. One is you're trying to save your business, which is not the ideal position to be in. And two is you see an opportunity. And when you see the opportunity, it's back to that equation. Like, I got to spend what on, you know, how much on what and when to get the return on investment so I can afford to pay back this loan. So that's all just built into our product and helping it be intuitive. And then of course, a lot of times, like if your data is not in a good spot, your credit's not good, your only loan option is expensive, then that kind of, it can kind of mess up the ROI calculation to where maybe that project's not going to be profitable and you shouldn't bite that project off.
Really well said. I find that entrepreneur understanding of risk management is generally has room for improvement. One thing, though, you triggered a thought, and this has come up a handful of times, especially on the podcast, especially with our venture debt lenders. Have you ever thought of, or do you ever take any steps to hedge your downside risk, whether it's with NAV or leading up to launching the company?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's depending on where you're at in the stage of the journey, it differs, right? Now, like now we have a nice bank line of credit that we can tap, and we got great terms on that line of credit. We've got cash on the balance sheet. And so it's easier at this stage. So I think about more things that are more catastrophic, like what about a security breach? What about, you know, can some new hotshot AI startup come and take down what took us 10, 11 years to build? Can they do it in 6 months? And to me, those are more catastrophic risks. Then there's the ones we can't control, the macroeconomy. For us, fortunately, our business is countercyclical. So we do good in a good economy. We do well. We do really well in a down economy because if you're a business owner and credit is easy to access and financing is easy to access, if all of a sudden the economy starts to sour, all of those lenders start to tighten their underwriting criteria. So what was easy is now more difficult or just turned off altogether. And so now you got to really dig in and figure out, okay, how do I button up my credit so that I can go get financing like I used to be able to. So we're fortunate that the macro isn't as much of a concern for us. And it's more like now it's actually a really complicated view of, okay, I raised this venture capital. The very first dollar in venture capital that you take, you make one permanent commitment, and that is you're going to provide liquidity. So you lose optionality in the business to just say, ah, I'm going to be a lifestyle business. You know what? I kind of like where we're at, and this is enough. So there always has to be something more. You've got to drive more customers, more revenues. Like, what's the next product innovation that's going to be a new vector of revenue growth? And so that's not, it gets easier to decide where to point that, but it's not easier to build when you're working on a new vector of growth. So risk planning for us at this stage is, you know, we built this asset, it's worth a lot of money. Our earliest backers, you know, are the institutional seed fund that led that round. That was fund two. They're on fund seven. He's returned that fund, I think, six times, but he's not collecting fees. And so now we're overhead. We're still upside, but we're overhead. And so for me, like, I have a fiduciary duty to drive liquidity to those investors. And so that's more the lens that I think through as I think of the coming years, where now, fortunately, I don't need outside capital. That's a marvelous place to be in. I'm sure with all the founders you've talked to, like, it's magical when you don't need someone else's money anymore, but you might not be growing as fast as you need to. So you may need to get additional capital. Or in our case, you know, I think we'll look at inorganic growth, and that brings us a whole new set of risks if you're trying to bite off someone else's business and incorporate it to your own. So there's still a learning curve ahead of me as it relates to how do we allocate capital and march towards providing liquidity. And our next round of financing would probably be, you know, that $200, $300 million round where early investors can get some money or all of their money if they want. Early employees can finally get some liquidity that exercised and pays for options. And I take a lot of pride in that. Like, that'll be a magical moment for me on a personal level, just to know, like, those people bet on my dream, my vision. I take that personal. And whether it was their own money or other people's money, they took career risks. And, the people that work at Nav are incredibly talented. They go get another job overnight. And so they've chosen to make this part of their career about my dream. And so it's fun. Like, the whole journey's been fun for me, but it's fun to be in the how big can we make it versus like, is it gonna be big? Are we gonna deliver a donut? Or is this gonna be, incredible upside for everybody?
Yeah, and credit to you for having the wherewithal to see the big picture. I don't know that many founders necessarily have your perspective, and I think the fact that you're conscious of the people who have helped get you where you are is to be applauded. So high five.
Thank you.
You made mention about raising capital. Without disclosing anything confidential, would love to know how you think about dilution along your way, and whether or not it's you knew it was always going to be equity, whether or not you ever considered debt, and how you've just thought about that as over the preceding 10 years.
Yeah, so I made a lot of mistakes at my first tech company, and fortunately, knock on wood, haven't made any of those mistakes at Nav, in specifically on this topic. And so at Nav, I put in the first $500,000. We got to revenues. I actually took a loan from a revenue-based financing shop. Say shop was just a guy who'd exited his company, understood how early tech worked, pick up some warrants. So like, the riskiest end of venture debt, but it's just an individual. And I took that loan so that I could push out when I had to actually take venture capital and start to experience that dilution. So I was pretty sensitive. And then when we raised our seed round, I felt like I would be able to make progress faster. So it was a $1 million seed round, but I only had to take a $500,000, and I could call as much as I wanted to the other $500,000 within a year without going back to Invesco. And so it was super flexible. Well, towards the end of that year, it was clear we were getting close to our A round, so I didn't want to tap the $500,000. So I hit up the founder of that fund and said, "Hey, look, let's be reasonable here. Like, I'm worthy of a better valuation." So he introduced me to a few of his LPs. They each wrote a small check as a convertible note, so that floated me to the A round. And then I do think of dilution a little bit differently than some founders. So at my A round, it was a pretty competitive round. I got five term sheets. I had two term sheets in hand, and I had three investment committee meetings on the same day, 2 hours apart on Sand Hill Road. It's like it could be an episode of Silicon Valley, like your dream scenario for FOMO. But I knew I wanted to work with Randy Kalmazar at Kleiner Perkins, because the second time in raising money, I realized like, this is a marriage. Like, whoever I'm working with, I'm signing up for a marriage, and I want to really zero in on that human being. Who are they? What drives them? So I ask VCs when I'm talking to them, or future investors, like, I ask them a lot of questions. They don't get asked. Like, what's getting you out of bed in the morning? Why this? Like, how do you find meaning in your life? Where does it come from? What's the three times that you have like you're the most embarrassed about in your career because of something you did to a founder, or in how you responded to a founder? And so I knew I wanted to work with him, and luckily got a term sheet. And so I'm getting back. I promise I'm going to answer the dilution question. And so I got the term sheet, and I did the math, and it was, I forget the specific numbers, but it was like a $6 million term sheet, or maybe it was five, on a pre-money that would give Kleiner Perkins 30%. And the range of dilution for an A round, 20 to 30%, right? Like, that's a market. They want to be on one end, I want to be on the other. And I always joke that the best terms for a financing round are mutually disagreeable. That's how you know you got to the right spot. Everybody's, equally unhappy with it around the table. And so I asked him, I said, like, what matters to you? Like, what's your actual number, right? Because firms will have guidance for the partners where they're like, hey, at this firm, we don't do an A round unless we're picking up 20%. But the partner can overlay their own rules on top of that and say, like, well, for me, it's X. And he said, look, I don't know what Kleiner Perkins was, because I didn't care. I care what his was. Like, what does he want in this deal? And he said, look, I really want to have 27%. I love this deal. I want to work with you. I'll go down to 25. And I said, how about you give me an extra $2 million and I'll give you the 27. He said, done. So we just adjusted the terms. And so in my mind, I want him to have what he wants, because I don't want to be the deal he regrets doing. I want to be like one of his priorities. I want to be a priority to the fund. And then that extra $2 million, I pretended I didn't have. So that's like, I'm going to make this all happen on the $5 million. And so you can kind of make it up. And I did make it up at the next round, where now I had an extra $2 million to make up more progress. So then I could be on the other end of the range, hopefully at the next round. But a lot of founders really try to squeeze the blood out of, all the juice out. And then it's like, you get this bloody negotiation and now you're married. It's like, what? That's like not an intuitive way for me to start out a marriage. I want them to get what they want as well. And so, fast forward, raised $100 million, got great investors. We got Experian, Goldman Sachs, Point 72, Crosslink Capital, just a great roster of investors. I've got 15% of the company. I think part of it depends on your motives. Like, do you want to own 15% of a multi-billion dollar company, or do you want to own 80% of a $200 million company? And for me, it's not like my motive set isn't like I always. To me, it's just silly. The would-be celebrity of being a venture-backed CEO, I think, is the silliest shit. Like, I'm just like everybody else. I picked a different path. I'm not better than anyone else in what their career path is. So I don't care about the celebrity of it. And I had a big house on the hill. I kind of felt like that house owned me. And so I'm going to be able to afford the house I want the rest of my life. And so for me, it's about, at the end of the day, the customer. Are we delivering that value? That's how we drive enterprise value, is by driving value to our customers with more and more scale. And then my investors and employees, everybody's going to make plenty of money. But I was worried about dilution only to like the rational level that you should, but not like zeroed in and paranoid about like, well, it can't slip below X. It's like my job is to make the pie bigger. Whatever percentage I have left over is going to be a consequence of how big the pie is that we keep making here.
Really well said. So with that, what are your expectations from your investors? What level of support do you prefer?
I don't like intrusive investors. So I'm the one that has the context. And lots of investors think they're being helpful. They'll lob something over the fence and it's like, this is not useful, but now I have an obligation to follow up on it. So this is actually taking away from my time, which is zero sum. The CEO's time is simultaneously the company's most valuable resource and its most constrained. So I don't want stuff lobbed over the fence at me. Anything that I'm dealing with that I don't have to, like, actually reduces the probability of success, but I want them to be responsive. I want them to be there when I need them, and I wasn't a first-time founder, so like I know how to make payroll. Don't need to remind me that like we got to keep our corporate certificate up to date, right? Like somebody who raises money when they're 25 and they were only ever an IC, like now they're a CEO, like that's a bigger lift. Like you don't understand what payroll is, and like, hey, there's this thing called FICA, and you got to pay it on your, you pay half of that. What? I saw that coming out of my check. I didn't realize the company was paying half of it. I'd been around the block, so I didn't need help with the basic blocking and tackling. For me, with Randy, it was mainly strategy, like leadership development. I needed to learn and grow as a leader. Every dollar in revenue that we add at this point, I'm leading the biggest company I've ever led. And so I can never be passive. And it's like, okay, I nailed it. Like I'm great at what I do. I've always got to be learning and growing. So with the investors, I want them to hustle when I need them to hustle, but I don't want the intrusion of them assuming they know at any given time what matters most and what's going to actually be helpful.
That's brilliant. Was there anything in particular that happened that informs how your profile of the ideal investor and what you knew you wanted to avoid?
Just the collective experience at my previous company, but I don't want to. I got to be careful because like we had great investors, and I respect and have gratitude to those folks to this day. For me, it was at least in the early rounds, I didn't need fintech expertise. I needed someone who had been there and done that at levels that I hadn't. So the partner, Kleiner Perkins, he was a three-time operator before he became an investor. Two big wins and a big failure right in the middle of those two wins, which at the time was the biggest venture-backed failure at all time. It was the first venture-backed company to raise $100 million and go bankrupt, the Go Corporation. He was part of a founding dream team. Bill Campbell, I think, was the CEO, like a Silicon Valley legend. So I wanted someone who'd been in the throes of what I was doing versus a lifetime investor. And so for me, it was more about that. Like I wanted someone that could have empathy. And that wasn't there to tell me what to do, was there to help me find my own truths. Because there's not a single personality type that builds billion-dollar companies. It's all personality types, every flavor of human. And you've got to find what's your flavor that's authentic, that's going to go the distance. And that was what I wanted in just that anchor kind of lead investor per se. And then you didn't ask this specifically, but I think it's worth saying is in my previous company, I felt like all the investors kind of had the same background. So the next investor wasn't necessarily accretive as an intellectual voice around the table. And so I was very deliberate NAV. Our A round is best in class venture capitalist. Our B round was led by Experian. So then I have a credit bureau's perspective that's in a business that's very analogous to what I do on the direct to consumer side. Goldman Sachs led my C round. And then my independent board members, former Visa. And so I have a VC's perspective. I have a credit bureau's perspective. I have a bank's perspective, which is even more broadly kind of a Wall Street perspective. And then I have a network's perspective. So I just wanted very complementary perspectives on life and strategy and things like that. It's been amazing for us. We have an amazing board and there's no clones on the board. Like I don't want to clone two people that think the same way and have the same subset of life experiences. The odds of them bringing something differentiated and accretive to me are lower. And so that was a big focus for me at the board level. And then that trickles down to how I build teams broadly, like my executive team and the diversity of thought and background there.
That's brilliant. Diversity of perspective has come up on the podcast before, but not framed necessarily from, arguably a mentorship perspective that the board serves. Great idea. So with that, you mentioned your teams. Obviously they've had a material hand in helping build the business. What's the journey been like? Key lessons learned over the last 10 years that are top of mind.
Yeah, I have some really deliberate answers to that because I was a CEO, the first founding CEO the first 8.5 years, closed our C round, had $60 million in the bank. I was only ever in good standing. Business was on the trajectory it needed to be, and I started to have panic attacks. And I'd never had mental health problems. Like my mind was a steel trap. Like there was nothing I was more proud of than my mind and how well it functioned in like the hardest of times. And so it came out of nowhere, derailed me. I went to work on it, a very supportive board. And towards the end of the beginning of 2020, I said, I'm not going to escape this hell while I'm still CEO. So we promoted the COO to CEO. I took the executive chairman role, took some time off, got my mental health under in a very healthy spot now. But I had time to reflect on this whole career of being in charge, whether it was the CEO or the owner in a small business. You don't call yourself a CEO in a small business usually. And really, like I'm a pensive guy. No one's harder on me than I am on myself. Like no one's gonna hold me more accountable than I will hold myself accountable. So I actually had a few years to clear my head and think, man, if I could do it over again, what would I do differently? And I'm an optimist to a fault. I believe in people. Like I'm an underdog guy. Like I believe in underdogs. And like I see myself as an underdog. I know I'm privileged white guy in a lot of ways, but I was raised in a house with no technology. It was very old school. And it's very improbable that I was going to end up in Silicon Valley raising venture capital and scaling a national company. And so this will sound harsh, but I believed in people too long. So I could see more in someone than they could see in themselves, but someone can't give you what you can see. They can give you what they can see. And so I got to the point where I realized, okay, I never moved people along fast enough. That was one of my top few things. Another one was because I'm an optimist, all of your quarterly exec strategy planning, I really struggled to get the amount of priorities down to a manageable, respectable number. And if you bite off too much, some doesn't get done. And then the things that do get done, you probably got a little more tech debt than you should have. It's probably like an 8 out of 10 versus a 10 out of a 10 for the customer. So those were the third is just I never took care of my mental health. With those two, it was like a sad hypothetical. I was like, man, I could be so much better if I was a CEO again. But I didn't want to start another company. NAV is like my life's work. It's my legacy. It's, as you know, now my whole career led to this moment in time, and I want to leave this lasting impact on small business. And so I couldn't just take the CEO job back. That's not how it works. So it took the previous CEO struggling for a period of time to get that opportunity. So when the board turned to me and said, "Hey, you ready to go?" I said, "I'm ready to go." And there were some dumpster fires to put out, both performance wise on our KPIs, but also the culture. Like it was a sour company. And if people aren't happy where they're at, they're not giving their heart, you're not getting all that someone has to give. And I'd never done a turnaround. And so that was like a new challenge. Like, okay, I'm going to do a turnaround. Glad I'm doing it at my own company. But I went into it with those things in mind, like I'm going to be way better in these ways. And so, you know, we turned around the business remarkably fast. We just did every few months we do the employee engagement sentiment survey that's anonymous, and came back. We're up every quarter, but like, this is the full time. It's like, okay, it's going to be really hard to improve from here because we're ranked so high on everything. So everybody's happy. They're mentally engaged. We're winning their hearts and their minds. But just not going to make those mistakes again. If someone isn't able to grow fast enough because they don't want to, and it sounds heartless, and I'm not a heartless guy, but like, they don't feel good. Nobody feels good in a role that they know that they're failing consistently or not doing quite well enough. And then a lot better priorities and making sure it's a narrower subset. And we really nail the things that we build. Our customer deserves that from us. They deserve our focus. So those are a few examples.
And you know, on a side note, kudos to you for being candid about your mental health. Not everyone would do that. So, that's fantastic to hear someone as successful yourself, you know, share that. So on the topic then on building culture, you know, is, I guess first question is, team remote, main office, satellite offices, how is the team structured? And then what steps, do you take, to foster culture?
So we have a physical office that I'm sitting in here in San Mateo. It's a small office. We have a large office in Utah. We used to be kind of those two geos based. In 2019, we started to go distributed just to unlock talent. And we were fortunate. So we had all the systems in place during COVID to say, all right, we're going just fully distributed. So now we got people in about 30 states plus Toronto. And it's easier to first of all, you're gonna have a culture no matter what, whether you're intentional about it or not. Like, one's gonna merge. It's a lot easier to influence that in the early years than it is in the later years. And it's a lot easier to do that when you're all in a single office than when you're distributed. So for me, culture can be defined lots of ways. Any respectable company should have a vision and a mission and a set of values. And the set of values should guide how do we treat each other and how do we treat the customer and the other important stakeholders of the business, like key channel partners, or in our case, credit bureaus, entities like that. And those values aren't for the outside world. Like, we put them on our website, but like, we don't care what anybody thinks. This is how we treat each other and how we think about the customer. And those have to be real. And they got to be a reflection of the founder or the CEO of the business. It's like, I'm too old to be somebody I'm not. I'm going to show up fully authentic every single day. I'm honest about what I'm not good at. I'm honest about what I'm good at. And for those things I'm good at, I my commitment to the team is I'm going to be the best on the planet at those things. And I'm not going to commit to be better than mediocre at everything else. So you have your values. Your culture isn't, do you have a pool tables? Like, do you have like 3-day weekends? Now, your culture is, how do you treat each other? And so that starts at the top, right? People want psychological safety. They want to feel personal and professional fulfillment in their job. But that personal side, a lot of CEOs don't think enough about. They want to feel personal fulfillment with the work that they do. And so when I came back to now, there wasn't psychological safety. People weren't empowered to do their best work. There was just tons of rules and bureaucracy and kind of artificial stuff slowing us down. I just tore all that out, like day one, made it clear, like, all we care about is the customer, and we're going to get back to winning for the customer. We're going to win as a consequence of that. And I used to, I'm a left brainer. Communication, like any topic of leadership, was not natural to me. Like, I was probably wired great as it relates to thinking through strategy and left brain business building. So commercialization, distribution, that kind of stuff was intuitive to me, but not as much the art of everything. And So I, in my 20s, you know, I'm 25 and I got like 80 people working for me. I don't know what I'm doing as a leader. And so I had a really painful experience as a leader where I realized I was a shitty leader, even though I thought I was good. Shitty as far as communication, motivation, like a subset of leadership. So I decided to go down this intellectual path of like, I'm going to study, read all these books. I read like 10 Peter Drucker books, like the driest material on the planet, but like good about management, but not as much leadership. And then, you know, I really focused over time on like, how do I motivate people intrinsically? That's where they can give their heart. You get way more out of somebody. That last 20% they have to give is like another X on top of the X they're already giving you. It's a multiplier on. And so how do you win the heart? Well, our vision and mission is one that's easy for the right people to rally around. We're leveling the playing field for small businesses. We have a strong impact on not just them, but their local communities. And so I really tried to become a better and better leader over time. And then Randy Commissar at Kleiner Perkins flew out when we were mostly in Utah. We'd fly our smaller California folks out once a month, so we were all in person. He flew out and did a cute a fireside chat, and we're driving him back to the airport, just me, him, and one of our team members. And he asked Randy Commissar, he goes, what is a great leader? Like, what's great leadership? And this is after I'd studied, like, I probably read dozens of books on leadership, influence, brain science, like all these adjacent categories. And he said, you know, leadership is simple. If the CEO of a company cares about the customer and they care about their team and it's authentic and organic in how they show up, everything else is easy. And I, like, it all clicked in that moment. I cared about the customer, I cared about our team, it was authentic, and it showed up organically quite a bit, but I made sure it showed up a lot more organically. Then you win people's hearts, and they're incredibly forgiving. Like, by being transparent about what I'm not going to commit to be good at, it makes it kind of funny. Like, my quirks are now funny. Like, people have permission to laugh. Like, I'm okay. Like, I'm yes, I'm eccentric. Like, I got my quirks, like a lot of founders do, or frankly, most humans have. And so that's kind of like the culmination of my life learnings on leadership, was just that poignant moment that the great leadership is you care about the customer, you care about your team, it's authentic and organic in how you show up, and you'll screw up, you'll make mistakes, but people will be incredibly forgiving because they know where your heart's at. So it just goes back to that intent. Now, that's probably not true in every industry and every geo around the world, but in the venture-backed tech world, where almost everyone at a tech company deliberately chose tech as their career, whether you're in customer care or you're software engineer, a moment came where you said, like, I want to work in tech. And so those are people that got options. And so if they want to feel that what they do has meaning and that the person at the top actually cares about the work that they perform. So I say, I take it personal. Like, business to me is not business. It's only personal. Businesses are created by people and they serve people. I hate the saying, it's just business to me. That's some asshole made that up as an excuse, and it caught on because it's catchy. But to me, business is only personal. But that's kind of the evolution of how I think I've thought about leadership over time. I'll tell you what, it's a lot simpler than like these complex leadership matrix, and like, it's like, no, it's actually way more simple than that.
Yeah, and I love how the fact that you call out that success follows, you know, when you focus on your client, your customer, and taking care of people, because it's been my experience as well. You know, money is just you know, representative of the scoreboard, which is a derivative of how you think about delivering value to your clients. Levi, it's been an awesome podcast. One of the questions I'd love to wrap up with is, if you had an opportunity to go back and talk to your younger self, what would you share with them?
That's a great question. I think I wouldn't change my journey because one thing led to another, and I felt like this life algorithm has brought me to an incredible place. But I would scream in my younger self's ear. Sorry, get like emotional, mental health, like, you gotta stay on top of it. Like, I never thought I would get to a time I would break. And you know, when I started working with a psychologist and therapist, the psychologist, I'm like, how did this happen? Like, I've been like, my mind's a steel trap. And she's like, that's like the 50-year-old that bends over to pick up a pencil and their back goes out. It wasn't picking up the pencil, it was an accumulation of not taking care of your back. And she's like, you haven't done that for your mind. But those were some dark, dark times. And that's why I'm so open about it now, because I felt ashamed. Like I didn't ask for it. Like I'm not ashamed. I have a birth heart defect. I'm not ashamed. Like I didn't ask for that. And so that's the message I would give to my younger self is figure out mental health and get ahead of it and don't take it for granted because when it breaks, it'll put you in a dark spot and it's a deep hole that's hard to dig out of. You can dig out of it, but it's better to never fall in that hole to begin with.
Yeah, and obviously today, you know, it's a much broader, deeper topic with a whole host of great resources out there to help entrepreneurs, founders, manage their mental health and ensure that, you know, that the what's a great way to frame it, quality of life is there. So that, and I don't know that balance is the right word, but I'll use balance to make sure that, you know, we're able to perform at a high level consistently over years. So I do think it's a marathon. Sometimes it's a sprint. I do think it's a marathon.
Yeah, I agree.
Good stuff. Well, Levi, thank you so much. If there's anyone who's listening to this and would like to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
LinkedIn, Levi King. Don't Google me unless you put Nav in there because there's a very prolific and media hungry serial killer named Levi King. That's not me. But I write a lot for Inc. and Forbes and Entrepreneur, but LinkedIn is the easiest way to find me.
Fantastic. Great. Levi, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it. Again, for our audience, Levi King, CEO and Chairman of Nav. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, Founder, CEO of FinStrat Management. Thank you for joining us.
You bet. My pleasure.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors podcast. If you are a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.